Chapter 8. The Future of Physics. The remarkable success of 20th century physics might suggest that all we have to do is iron out a few creases, refine our experimental measurements, and put the finishing touches to our mathematical theories. That most of what there is to know is already known, and we're just dotting a few I's and crossing the final T's. You may have got the impression that there's no need for another Newton or Einstein, or indeed a Maxwell, Rutherford, Bohr, Dirac, Feynman, Witten, or Hawking to come along and bring about a new revolution in physics, because we're already within touching distance of a theory of everything that explains the workings of the entire universe. Unfortunately, or fortunately if you're a research physicist just starting out in your career and looking for big problems to tackle, the truth is far from this. In fact, I would say that we're further away from the end of physics today than we thought we were 20 or 30 years ago. We speak of the Standard Model as describing all the elementary building blocks of matter and energy, but we're now pretty sure that everything we've found only makes up 5% of the universe. The other 95%, known as dark matter and dark energy, is still, to some extent, mysterious. We're confident it's out there, but we don't know what it's made of or how it fits into our current theories. In this chapter, I will explore this mystery, along with other outstanding challenges in fundamental physics. Dark matter. The rotational speed of galaxies, the motion of entire galaxies within galaxy clusters, as well as the large-scale structure of the entire universe, all point towards a significant component of the universe consisting of a near-invisible matter component. We call it dark, not because it's hidden behind other visible matter, or even because it's actually dark, but because, as far as we can tell, it doesn't feel the electromagnetic force, and so doesn't give off light or interact with normal matter other than gravitationally, and so a better name for it would have been invisible matter. Of course, there are other matter particles, such as neutrinos, that also don't feel the electromagnetic force. However, they interact instead with other matter via the weak nuclear force, and so are not what is referred to as dark matter. Even dark matter itself may yet be found to interact via one or more of the other three forces, but it would have to be very weakly indeed, or we would have measured it by now. Physicists haven't entirely given up hope of such a small, non-gravitational interaction, as that would increase the chances of dark matter particles being detected or created in an accelerator. Think for a moment about why, if you slam your hand down on a solid table, it doesn't pass straight through. You might regard this as trivial. Surely it's because both your hand and the table are made of solid stuff. But don't forget that down at the level of atoms, matter is mostly empty space. Diffuse clouds of electrons surrounding a tiny nucleus. And so there should be plenty of room for the atoms that make up your hand to easily pass through the atoms of the table without any physical matter coming into contact. The reason they don't is because of the electromagnetic force between the electrons in the atoms of your hand and the electrons in the atoms of the table, repelling each other and providing the resistance we experience as solidity. However, if your hand were made of dark matter, then it would pass straight through as though the table weren't there, the gravitational force between them being too weak to have much effect. It has long been known that galaxies have much more mass than can be accounted for if one measures all the normal matter they contain, in the form of stars, planets, and interstellar dust and gas. At one point, it was thought that dark matter might be made up of long-dead stars and black holes, objects made of normal matter, but which do not emit light. However, overwhelming evidence now suggests that this invisible stuff must be made up of a new form of matter, most likely a new type of particle yet to be discovered. Originally, dark matter was proposed to explain the large-scale dynamics of entire clusters of galaxies. Further evidence then came from the way stars moved within spiral galaxies, circulating like undissolved coffee granules on the surface of a mug of instant coffee after it has been stirred. Most of the stars, and hence, you would think, most of the mass in a galaxy, are concentrated at its core, which would require those in the outer rim to be moving around the centre more slowly. The observed higher-than-expected orbital speeds of these outer stars suggests that there must be some additional invisible stuff present, extending out beyond the visible matter we can see and providing the extra gravitational glue to stop the outer stars from flying off. Dark matter can also be seen from the way it curves space around it. This phenomenon manifests itself in the way light bends while on its path from very distant objects to our telescopes. The amount of bending can only be explained by the extra gravitational curvature of space provided by the dark matter of galaxies that the light passes on its way to us. So what do we know about dark matter other than it provides this necessary extra gravitational attraction? Might this not be accounted for by something less exotic than a new form of matter? Indeed, some astrophysicists suggest that there may be no need for dark matter at all if we're allowed to modify the properties of the gravitational force at large distances. An idea known as MOND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics, is one such suggestion. And on the face of it, this idea can sound quite appealing. However, while MOND, or other related hypotheses that modify general relativity, can explain away some of the observed effects, there's plenty that they do not explain. None of these models have been able to match the observational data for galaxy clusters, particularly colliding galaxy clusters such as the famous Bullitt cluster, the detailed structure of the cosmic microwave background radiation, globular star clusters, or, more recently, tiny dwarf galaxies. The existence of dark matter also seems necessary to explain the structure of the early universe. In contrast with normal matter, which through its interaction with the electromagnetic field kept its energy high, dark matter cooled down more quickly as the universe expanded, and therefore started to clump together gravitationally earlier. One of the most important results in astrophysics in recent years has been the confirmation from sophisticated computer simulations of galaxy formation that we can only explain the real universe if it does indeed contain large quantities of dark matter. Without it, we would not get the rich cosmic structures we see today. Put more bluntly, without dark matter, most galaxies, and hence stars and planets, could never have formed in the first place. This remarkable conclusion is supported beautifully by data showing subtle fluctuations in the temperature of deep space. The imprint of the very young universe on the cosmic microwave background radiation. It was recognized back in the late 1970s that these fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, while helpful in providing the seeding for the present-day distribution of matter in the universe, were too tiny to explain how galaxies could form. Dark matter helped provide the extra clumping that was needed. It was one of the great scientific triumphs of the end of the 20th century when the Kobe satellite measured these fluctuations to be just what had been predicted. Kobe, or the Cosmic Background Explorer, also referred to as Explorer 66, was a satellite dedicated to cosmology, which operated from 1989 to 1993. Its goals were to investigate the cosmic microwave background radiation of the universe. Since then, further space missions have mapped these wrinkles in the cosmic microwave background with ever-increasing resolution. NASA's WMAP mission in the first decade of this century, then the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, which launched in 2009. While we're left in little doubt that dark matter is real, we're still in the dark as to what it's made of. It's a growing source of frustration in astrophysics that, in parallel with the accumulation of evidence in support of dark matter, we fail to find out what it actually is. The consensus now is that it consists of a new type of heavy particle, heavy by the standards of elementary particles, that is. And most of the experimental effort thus far has been focused on building sophisticated underground detectors that can capture extremely rare events when such a dark matter particle streaming in from space collides head-on with an atom in the detector. To date, no signal from these increasingly sophisticated and sensitive experiments has been picked up. And yet, physicists looking for dark matter remain optimistic. Most likely, they say, it will be in the form of slow-moving particles, making up what is known as cold dark matter. And there's no shortage of suggestions for what these particles might be, with such wonderful-sounding names as axions, sterile neutrinos, WIMPs, or weakly interacting massive particles, and GIMPs, gravitationally interacting massive particles. Many feel confident that experimental evidence will emerge soon. But then we've been saying that for some time now. I should at this point say just a little about neutrinos, which for a while were the leading candidates for dark matter. These are elusive yet abundant particles that we know exist, which have a tiny mass and are almost invisible. You would need a light year's thickness of lead shielding to have even a 50-50 chance of blocking them. You could say that they are, to all intents and purposes, dark matter. However, they cannot be the dark matter that we're searching for, because being so light, they travel at near light speed. Too fast to remain bound within galaxies and thus to explain galaxies' anomalous properties. We refer to neutrinos as hot dark matter because they move so fast. And as if the unresolved problem of dark matter weren't big enough for physicists, we now know of another mysterious substance filling the universe, which plays a vital role in shaping it. Dark energy. In 1998, astronomers studying the faint light of supernovae in distant galaxies used it to calculate the speeds at which those galaxies were receding from us due to the expansion of the universe. They found that they were moving away more slowly than their distance from us suggested they should be. Since the light now reaching us from these galaxies left them when the universe was very young, their slower-than-expected recession speeds means that the universe must have been expanding more slowly in the past. So rather than the cumulative gravitational attraction of all the matter in the universe, both normal and dark matter, slowing down the expansion of the universe, something else was at work, making it expand more quickly now than it did in the past. This mysterious, repulsive substance acting against gravity and stretching space ever more quickly became known as dark energy. According to our present understanding, dark energy may ultimately result in what is called the heat death of the universe, many billions of years from now, as space continues to expand ever more rapidly and to cool as it settles towards a state of thermodynamic equilibrium. But until we truly understand the nature of dark energy, and indeed the properties of the very early universe, which we'll discuss in the next section, we should not be too quick to conjecture about its final fate. It's a long way off, and anything could happen between now and then. Until a few years ago, I would have said we know even less about dark energy than we do about dark matter. But that is now changing. There is a quantity in Einstein's equations of general relativity known as the cosmological constant, and denoted by the Greek letter lambda, that fits the bill. What we call dark energy is most likely the energy of empty space itself, what is referred to as the quantum vacuum. We've seen how everything ultimately comes down to quantum fields in the end. All the different particles that make up matter and energy, whether quarks, electrons, photons, or Higgs bosons, can be regarded merely as localized excitations of these quantum fields, like waves on the surface of an ocean. However, if you were to remove all the particles from a volume of space, this does not get rid of the field. Instead, we say it's left in its ground or vacuum state. but there will still be virtual particles popping in and out of existence within this vacuum all the time, borrowing the energy from their surroundings in order to exist, but paying it back just as quickly when they disappear again. So to say that the quantum vacuum of empty space has zero energy will be the same as claiming a calm ocean has no depth. The equivalent of water beneath the ocean surface is this dark energy. It is the cosmological constant. However, having a mathematical symbol for dark energy does not mean we entirely understand its nature yet. Astronomical measurements suggest that the cosmological constant has a certain numerical value. But, like the mass of the Higgs boson in the Standard Model, we don't know why it has this value. This long-standing problem in physics is known as fine-tuning, and is very unsatisfying. In fact, things are even worse than this. The discrepancy between this calculated vacuum energy from quantum field theory and the observed vacuum energy from cosmological measurements is so huge that it's one of the most embarrassing and unresolved problems in physics. You see, the calculated value is a ridiculous 120 orders of magnitude bigger than the observed value. Our best guess cosmological model, the equivalent of the Standard Model in particle physics, which contains under its umbrella what we currently know about dark matter and dark energy, is called the Lambda CDM model, or the Lambda Cold Dark Matter model. And similar to the way deeper quantum field theories underpin the loose alliance of the Standard Model of particle physics, so too does general relativity underpin the Lambda CDM cosmological model. There's one more important ingredient of the Lambda CDM model, which most, but by no means all cosmologists, claim is needed to explain the properties of the universe we see. It's called cosmic inflation, and it provides a possible answer to that perennial question: how did the universe and all the matter and energy it contains come into being in the first place? Inflation and the multiverse. As we touched on at the very beginning of this book, since the dawn of human history, we've created many myths about the origins of the universe. Today, physics has given us a demystified explanation of how the universe began, with overwhelming observational evidence to back it up. But did the Big Bang itself have a cause? Was there something that triggered the birth of our universe in the first place? The simplest answer is that there was no before the Big Bang, for it marked the birth of both space and time. An idea put forward by Stephen Hawking and James Hartle, called the No Boundary Proposal, states that as we wind back the clock closer and closer to the Big Bang, time begins to lose its meaning and becomes more like a dimension of space. We therefore end up with smooth, four-dimensional space at a point of the universe's origin. So it's meaningless to ask what happened before the Big Bang, in the same way that it's meaningless to ask what point on the surface of the Earth lies south of the South Pole. But the Big Bang model is not enough on its own to explain the universe we see today. In particular, two problems puzzled cosmologists half a century ago. The first is called the flatness problem. This is yet another fine-tuning issue and relates to the density of matter and energy in the universe, which appears to have just the right value to make space almost perfectly flat. It's hard to visualize what we mean by flat 3D space. The easiest way is to imagine restricting our space to just two dimensions. Now it's clear that a page in a book is flat, whereas the surface of a ball is not. The second problem is called the horizon problem. The furthest we can see out into space is probably only a tiny fraction of the entire universe, and there exists a horizon beyond which we can never see. This horizon marks the edge of what is known as the visible universe. It exists because the universe hasn't been around forever, and light takes a certain time to reach us. An added complication is that the universe is expanding, and at some distance, space is stretching faster than light can travel through it, like trying to walk up a rapidly descending escalator. Consider a galaxy near the edge of the visible universe in one direction, and another galaxy near the edge in the opposite direction. Due to the expansion of the universe, any intelligent beings living in one of these distant galaxies would be completely unaware of the existence of the other galaxy, since light from it won't have reached them yet, nor will it ever. In fact, the regions of space containing the two galaxies could never have been in contact and cannot even have shared information. Why is this a problem? Because in every direction we look, and as far out as we can see, the universe looks the same. Both of those distant galaxies look very much the same, to us in between them, in terms of their physical properties, composition, and the structure of matter within them. How can this be if they were never in contact in the past? To solve these two issues, the flatness problem and the horizon problem, a concept known as cosmic inflation was proposed 40 years ago. It went like this. When the universe was just a fraction of a second old, it underwent a short period of exponential expansion due to yet another quantum field, called the inflaton field, during which it grew stupendously rapidly to a trillion, 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 trillion times the size it was before. This solves the problem of the finely tuned density, giving rise to the flat space-time we see today, because any tiny amount of curvature got stretched out by inflation. The way inflation solves the horizon problem is more interesting. The usual explanation is that distant parts of the universe that do not appear to ever have had a chance to be in contact and thus to synchronize their physical properties were in fact in contact at the beginning, but that inflation caused space to expand so rapidly they appear now to be too far apart to have ever been causally connected. I said this is the usual explanation, but if you think about it, there are two things not quite right with referring to inflation as being rapid expansion. First, for distant parts of the universe to be able to communicate with each other when they were close together, surely required them to stay closer together for longer, not zoom apart too quickly. Secondly, when we refer in mathematics to something being exponential, we mean that it varies slowly to begin with and then speeds up, the slope becoming steeper. This is a better way of thinking about the inflationary early universe. It started expanding slowly, then sped up. Then at some point, this exponential expansion changed to what is called a power law expansion, where instead of the expansion speeding up, it started to slow down again. Until, that is, dark energy kicked in halfway through the universe's life and started to speed the expansion up again. Of course, this tells you nothing about why the idea is so attractive, or why or how it works. So let us spend a little time unpacking its meaning. To appreciate how inflation works, you must first understand the difference between positive and negative pressure. Imagine you're holding an inflated balloon. The air inside it exerts a pressure on its inner surface, pushing outwards. If you were to now squeeze the balloon between your hands, you would be expending energy to compress its air to a smaller volume, increasing its density. And this energy gets stored in the balloon's air molecules. Now, consider the reverse process. Relax your hands so that the balloon expands back to its original size and the air inside becomes less dense again. The energy stored in its molecules must now also drop back to what it was originally. Of course, this energy doesn't return to the muscles in your arms, but is lost instead as waste heat to the balloon's surroundings. So allowing the volume inside the balloon to expand means its energy decreases. This is the situation with normal positive pressure. It loses energy as it expands. But what if the balloon were filled with an unusual substance that did the opposite? What if, when it expanded in volume, its density didn't drop but remained constant? And the energy per unit volume stayed the same too. So its total energy increased. This is what we mean by something with negative pressure. Instead of the energy of the balloon's contents increasing when compressed, it increases when it expands. The closest example to this in our everyday world is a rubber band, since stretching it puts more energy into it. And this is exactly what we have with the inflaton field filling space. It's like a rubber band and has the property that every time the volume of space doubles, its total energy also doubles in order to maintain a constant field density. So the inflaton field gives the universe energy, just as you would give a rubber band energy by stretching it. You should be asking two questions here. Firstly, why does the inflaton field cause the expansion of space? After all, a rubber band doesn't spontaneously expand of its own accord. And secondly, given that the inflaton field generates energy, where does that energy originate from? Both questions have crafty but logical answers that can be found, you won't be surprised to hear, in the equations of general relativity. Einstein's field equations tell us that gravity can be caused by pressure as well as by mass and energy. So while something with positive pressure, like the molecules of air in a balloon, gives rise to normal attractive gravity, a substance with negative pressure will cause the opposite, anti-gravity, pushing everything apart rather than pulling it together. The inflaton field has the property that the repulsive effect of its negative pressure or anti-gravity is bigger than the normal attractive gravity caused by its energy. And so it causes space to expand at an accelerating pace. As for where the energy of the inflaton field came from in the first place, the answer is that it is borrowed from its own gravitational field. Think of a ball on top of a hill. It has a store of positive potential energy that it can convert into kinetic energy if it rolls down. But a ball at the bottom of the hill has no potential energy, while a ball down in a hole has negative potential energy, since it needs energy put into it to lift it back up to ground level. It's as though our universe began with no space and no energy, but a quantum fluctuation caused it to start rolling down a gravitational energy slope. As it rolled down, it gained positive energy, paid for as it descended deeper into the gravitational valley by its increasing negative gravitational potential energy. Cosmologists refer to this as the ultimate free lunch, something from nothing. It's a very neat answer to the question, where did all the matter and energy in the universe come from in the first place? Another way of understanding why gravitational energy is negative is to consider the following example. Start with two masses, infinitely far apart, with zero gravitational energy between them. As they drift together, they will gradually gain in gravitational attraction. But this gravitational energy is negative, in the sense that you would need to put positive energy in to pull them apart again and get them back to the zero energy they started with. When inflation ended, the energy of the inflaton field decayed into normal energy, which condensed out into all the matter we have today. The stuff of the universe was created from energy borrowed from its own gravitational field, the ultimate in creative accounting. But just because inflation theory solves these problems in cosmology does not mean that it is correct. While most cosmologists subscribe to this theory, there are others who disagree, and there are indeed some subtle issues that have not yet been resolved. One critic is Stephen Hawking's long-term collaborator Roger Penrose. Instead of inflation, Penrose has proposed his own model, called conformal cyclic cosmology, in which the universe goes through an infinite series of epochs, each of which starts with a phase resembling a Big Bang. At the end of each cycle, all that remains, after even the black holes have evaporated, is thermal radiation. This, Penrose conjectures, is similar to the smooth, high-energy radiation that would fill the universe just after the Big Bang. And with a clever connection between the low entropy of the early universe and the high entropy at the end, nothing can escape the second law of thermodynamics, he can attach the end of one eon to the beginning of another and see everything start again with a new Big Bang. Suffice it to say that this proposal is even more controversial than inflation theory. And since we are deeply in the realm of speculation, why stop now? A fashionable idea in cosmology at the moment is known as eternal inflation. In this scenario, our universe is just a small bubble within an infinite, higher dimensional space known as the multiverse, which has been undergoing inflation forever. In this scenario, the Big Bang that created our universe was but a quantum fluctuation 13.82 billion years ago, which created a bubble in this eternally inflating space. The space within this bubble, our universe, stopped inflating and slowed down to expand at a more sedate rate, while the multiverse outside continued its runaway inflation. And so, rather than a very brief period of inflation taking place after the Big Bang, now we have things the other way round, with our Big Bang marking the end of inflation in our part of the multiverse. What's more, eternal inflation predicts that there will be other bubble universes within the multiverse, possibly an infinite number of them, all forever separated from each other and all being driven apart rapidly by the ever-expanding inflaton field. This idea has an added benefit that many cosmologists find appealing. I've mentioned before that physicists don't like fine-tuning, that is, for there to be no underlying reason for why certain physical quantities have the values they do. This comes to a head when we consider that our most fundamental constants have just the right values for a universe such as ours to exist. If gravity were ever so slightly weaker, galaxies and stars might never have formed. And if the charge on the electron were very slightly stronger, atoms would collapse and complex matter could not exist. So the eternal inflation multiverse theory answers the question, why is our universe so finely tuned as to be suitable for stars and planets and life to exist? The answer is that all possible bubble universes can exist, all obeying the same laws of physics, but each with its own set of fundamental physical constants. We just happen to be in one that is just right for life to emerge and contemplate how lucky it is. I should also add here, to avoid any confusion, these bubble universes are not the same as the parallel realities of the multiverse or many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which are due to the different possible outcomes of measurement of the quantum world. The bubble universes and the eternal inflation theory are not parallel, overlapping realities, but completely independent of each other. And before I move on, I want to add one more important point. We might wonder whether our universe is infinite in extent, even though we cannot see beyond our visible horizon, and it could well be. So how can infinite space fit inside a finite bubble floating in the multiverse alongside other bubble universes? The answer is rather strange. To us, on the inside, the universe could be infinite in extent, but finite in time. However, this is because we have a warped view of space and time from within our bubble. Viewed from the outside, our universe would appear finite in size, but existing in endless time. It's a neat way of understanding how infinite space can fit inside a finite volume, but it's really conceptually tough. Sorry. Information. One topic I've not said much about that brings together all three pillars of fundamental physics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, and thermodynamics, involves the role that information plays in physics. It's now understood that information is more than just an abstract notion and can in fact be quantified precisely. A long-standing puzzle, first highlighted by Stephen Hawking, was what happens to information, say this book I'm reading from, if you were to throw it into a black hole. The book will of course be lost forever, but what about the information it contained? By that I mean the physical information that is encoded in the words of the book and that will be required to reconstruct them. You see, quantum mechanics tells us that information cannot be destroyed and must always be conserved. This comes about because, according to quantum mechanics, time is reversible. Therefore, just as a quantum state now uniquely determines a future state, so should a future quantum state uniquely determine a past one. But this wouldn't be possible if the information contained in this state is destroyed. Hawking described how black holes slowly evaporate, losing their energy in what is known as Hawking radiation. And quantum mechanics tells us that, in principle, this radiation carries within it all the information that has been swallowed by the black hole, including the information needed to construct this book. Do we know this for sure? Again, only a final theory of quantum gravity is going to lay this issue to rest. The study of the mathematics of black holes has also led to the discovery that the maximum amount of information that can be stored in a volume of space is proportional not to the volume of space, as might be expected, but to the surface area surrounding that volume. This idea became known as the holographic principle and is proving to be a powerful tool in theoretical physics. At its heart, it comes about because of a profound connection between information and energy. By storing more and more information in a volume of space, you increase its energy. And since energy is equivalent to mass, this means strengthening its gravitational field, to the point when the volume of space will collapse into a black hole. The holographic principle states that all the information will now be encoded on the black hole's event horizon. It's thought that this idea even applies to the information needed to describe the entire universe. The role of information is likely to become increasingly important in connecting up the three pillars of physics. ER equals EPR. In 2013, two leading physicists, Juan Maldacena and Leonard Susskind, proposed an idea that might yet provide a new route towards unifying gravity and quantum mechanics. While it's far too early to judge if they might be right, it's also too fascinating for me not to mention it in passing. Known simply as ER equals EPR, it suggests that there may be a deep and profound link between quantum entanglement, two particles connected across space, and wormholes in space-time. But note that ER equals EPR is not an algebraic equation, despite the equal sign. Otherwise, you might wish to cancel the E and the R from both sides, leaving just P equals 1, which is meaningless. Instead, it refers to the initials of the authors, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, of two classic papers published just a few weeks apart in 1935. These two papers had hitherto been thought to be completely unrelated. ER refers to Einstein and Nathan Rosen, who proposed that two black holes might be linked by a tunnel outside our dimensions, an idea that emerged from the mathematics of general relativity. EPR refers to the second paper the two published with Boris Podolsky, in which they outlined their misgivings about the idea of entanglement in quantum mechanics, what Einstein referred to as spooky connections. The novel suggestion of Maldacena and Susskind is that both these profound ideas, wormholes and entanglement, might in fact be one and the same phenomenon. Time will tell if they're on the right track. A crisis in physics? Will we then ever reach a complete understanding of reality? Or will we be forever peeling back layers of the onion to reveal deeper truths underneath? This has certainly been true so far. First, we discovered that everything is made of atoms, then that these atoms are themselves made of smaller parts, electrons orbiting around a dense nucleus. Later, we peered into the nucleus itself to discover that it is made up of smaller building blocks, protons and neutrons, which in turn are composed of even tinier quarks, which are themselves manifestations of energy fields, or possibly even far smaller vibrating strings in higher dimensions. Will it ever come to an end? Some theoretical physicists, dazzled by the beauty of their equations, have ploughed on, postulating ever more exotic notions that have become increasingly difficult to test experimentally, judging them only on their explanatory power and mathematical elegance. Important criteria, I agree, but not the traditional benchmarks for validating scientific theories. So, instead of patting ourselves on the back for how far we've come, should we consider the possibility that we might be straying too far from the path of physics? Many physicists will no doubt argue that these past few years have been tremendously exciting for fundamental physics. Considering the widely reported discoveries of the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider in 2012, followed by gravitational waves at the LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory facilities in the United States in 2016. But the truth is that both these observational discoveries, vital though they are, merely confirm predictions made by theorists a long time ago. 50 years in the case of the Higgs, and a full century for gravitational waves. I know this sounds more than a little dismissive, and I don't want to downplay the extraordinary achievements of the thousands of experimental physicists and engineers who played a part in these two remarkable discoveries. But when I say merely, I mean that there weren't many physicists who didn't expect these experimental confirmations to be made one day. In the case of the Higgs, even though the discovery led to the award of the Physics Nobel Prize the following year, it went to the theorists who predicted it back in the 1960s, not to the experimentalists who made the confirming observation. I guess I should make a more careful distinction here between the discovery of the Higgs boson and detection of gravitational waves. The former was by no means a foregone conclusion. Many physicists, including Stephen Hawking, had doubted its existence before 2012. Gravitational waves, in contrast, were entirely expected, since they had not only been predicted by general relativity, but had been indirectly observed many years ago in the behavior of binary pulsars, pairs of neutron stars in orbit around each other. In fact, if I look back over the past 3 decades and consider some of the exciting breakthroughs and discoveries in fundamental physics, such as the top quark, Bose-Einstein condensates, quantum entanglement, neutron star mergers, and exoplanets, I could argue that none of these was completely unexpected. In fact, only one discovery in physics during this period was truly revolutionary and surprising to the astronomers who first saw it, if not all cosmologists, that of dark energy in 1998. Otherwise, when it comes to testing our theories and models at the furthest extremes of fundamental physics, the quantum and the cosmic scales, there has been experimental silence. Many of the ideas and speculative theories I've discussed in this chapter might well turn out to be correct. But it's worth pointing out that the traditional types of experiments that have served to verify or falsify scientific theories in the past are unlikely to be able to help us in the future to reach a sufficient level of confidence in their veracity. When the Large Hadron Collider first started running in 2010, it was only the latest in a long line of particle accelerators around the world, going back almost a century, that have been smashing subatomic matter together at increasingly higher energies. Physicists had waited a long time for the LHC and had high hopes that it would help them answer a number of outstanding questions and remove uncertainties from the standard model. But, above all else, it was billed as the accelerator that would find the Higgs boson. And it duly did. Surely a resounding success and a justification for the huge cost of the project. But since then, there's been mounting frustration that nothing more has been discovered, both from the scientists in other disciplines envious of the funding that CERN receives, and from theoretical physicists impatient for confirmation of their latest predictions. And what of the Higgs discovery itself? What new insights has it given us about the nature of matter? It's worth noting that the Higgs boson is merely the particle manifestation, excitation, of the more fundamental Higgs field, yet another quantum field that pervades all space and an important ingredient of the Standard Model, because the way other particles move through the Higgs field is what gives them their mass. For instance, the W and Z bosons, the carriers of the weak force, would have no mass without it, and will be more like their cousin, the massless photon. But the W and Z do have mass, and it's the Higgs mechanism that explains how they acquire it, through their interaction with the Higgs field, in a way that the photon does not. Final proof of the Higgs field's existence was found not by detecting it directly, but indirectly, through the creation of the effervescent quantum of the field, the Higgs boson. Finding the Higgs was a remarkable achievement, but in truth, it was a box to be ticked. The Higgs field was bolted onto the Standard Model, which lived to fight another day. The discovery of the Higgs hasn't opened up many new avenues in fundamental physics research, because it didn't progress our understanding beyond what physicists already knew and expected. The Standard Model remains a consistent framework for our understanding of the building blocks of matter, but it is not a fully coherent or predictive unified theory. Of course, there are still plenty of data to sift through at the LHC from the most recent run, which came to an end in December 2018, so we might still find something new once all the data have been analysed. But the fact remains that there are still a number of outstanding questions to answer, and we may have to look beyond the LHC to do so. These questions include, why is gravity so much weaker than the other forces? Why are there just three generations of quarks and leptons? And where does the Higgs' own mass come from? Probably most pressing of all, and therefore most frustrating because it has not been found, is whether we will find any evidence of supersymmetry. Just because we want supersymmetry to be true does not make it so. Sure, it solves many problems and provides useful insights. It's also neat and logical and aesthetically pleasing. But the longer we go without finding any experimental proof of supersymmetry, the more frustrated we become. At the same time, critics of superstring theory grumble that the field continues to be attractive to the brightest minds because it offers jobs. Young researchers feel safer following in the footsteps of their professors and fear that if they don't, they will lose out on funding and career progression. Meanwhile, university physics departments competing for scarce resources see research in string theory as a cheap way of working at the forefront of physics. But as long as progress remains slow, with no new experimental evidence emerging to bolster the efforts of those in the field, dissenting voices will grow louder. Some might argue that if supersymmetry is correct, then we should probably have found evidence of it by now at the LHC. The simplest class of supersymmetry models, what is called constrained minimal supersymmetry, is already looking unlikely. But this does not mean that we give up on it entirely just yet. We may just be looking for it in the wrong place. After all, it's not only on string theorists' wish lists. More down-to-earth particle physicists also want to know if nature is supersymmetric. Supersymmetry allows us to understand a connection between the electroweak force and the strong nuclear force, described by QCD. It also links together the matter particles and the force carrier particles. It would even explain why the Higgs boson has the mass that it does. But solving all these problems comes at a price. Supersymmetry predicts the existence of a whole host of new particles that have yet to be discovered. I should, of course, say that there is a nice added bonus if supersymmetry is true. The lightest of these yet-to-be-observed supersymmetric particles fit the bill as the constituents of dark matter. Reasons to be optimistic. Theoretical physicists have not just been sitting around waiting on news from their experimental colleagues. Enthralled by the splendour of their mathematics, they've forged ahead without them. No sooner had the latest version of string theory, M theory, been proposed in the mid-1990s by Edward Witten, than a powerful new idea was developed by Juan Maldacena in 1997. It's known as gauge-gravity duality, or to give it its technical name, ADS-CFT, which stands for Anti-de Sitter Conformal Field Theory Correspondence, and it describes how the strings in string theory relate to the field theories describing the three quantum forces. This mathematical idea has since been developed more generally to tackle problems in other areas of theoretical physics, such as hydrodynamics, quark-gluon plasmas, and condensed matter. And Maldacena's paper has become one of the most important pieces of work in modern theoretical physics, having been cited over 17,000 times in other peer-reviewed papers to date. Powerful ideas like gauge-gravity duality convince many physicists that string theory is the right path to pursue. But even if it turns out not to be the correct theory of quantum gravity, what it has done is provide physicists with a useful and precise mathematical toolbox that has at least shown us there is a way of combining quantum mechanics and general relativity consistently. And so it gives us hope that the project of unification is in principle possible. But the fact remains that just because string theory or gauge gravity duality are mathematically beautiful, this does not make them true. Where will the final answer come from then? Maybe from string theory, maybe from the study of black holes, maybe from those working on quantum information theory trying to build quantum computers, or maybe even from condensed matter theory. It's becoming clearer that similar forms of mathematics apply across all these areas. In the search for a correct theory of quantum gravity, we may not even need to quantize gravity after all. Maybe trying to force quantum field theory and general relativity towards each other is the wrong approach. There's some evidence that quantum field theories may already contain within them the essence of curved space-time, and that general relativity may be closer to quantum mechanics than we thought. It would be fascinating to know which of the many ideas and theories in this chapter turn out to be correct, and which will be consigned to the rubbish heap of wrong science. For me personally, the biggest unanswered question in physics is one that has vexed me all my professional life. What is the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics? In Chapter 5, I touched on a few of the candidate ideas and mentioned that for many physicists, this really is a problem for the philosophers to address. Since it has not stopped the application of quantum mechanics or slowed the progress of physics. But a growing number of physicists, including yours truly, see the foundations of quantum mechanics as a vitally important field and suspect that a resolution of the long-standing issue of its interpretation will ultimately lead to new physics. It may even be linked to one or more of the other outstanding problems in fundamental physics, such as the nature of time or the ultimate theory of quantum gravity. These problems sometimes seem so difficult to overcome that it wouldn't surprise me if we ended up needing an advanced artificial intelligence to help us. Maybe an AI of our invention will emerge as the next Newton or Einstein. And we may have to accept that our puny human brains are just not smart enough to figure out the ultimate nature of reality on our own. Maybe it'll inform us that the answer is, indeed, 42. I focused in this chapter on the future of physics, mainly with regard to mathematical physics and physics at the extremes of the very smallest and largest scales. But is this fair? Are these justifiably the true frontiers of physics? Advances in physics are not all about striving to see smaller or further, and the everyday scales, in terms of size and energy, are no less fascinating. In fact, in terms of how physics will transform our lives in the 21st century, the real excitement is in areas like condensed matter physics and quantum optics, and in areas in which physics overlaps and merges with chemistry, biology, and engineering. So, rather than delve into some of those topics here, I will use them as examples of how the technological applications of physics are shaping our world. And I will explore these, some might say more useful, aspects of the physics enterprise in the next chapter.